This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. What if discovering life-saving drugs didn't take years of trial and error, but could be predicted in advance? Today, we're joined by Matthew Sigmund, Distinguished Professor of Chemistry at the University of Utah, whose latest research is changing how new medicines are made. Now, by combining chemistry with machine learning, his team has developed a way to predict how molecules will form, especially the critical right version that can heal rather than harm. The result, fewer experiments, lower costs, and a faster path from idea to treatment. Matt Sigmund, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much.
So this is really a fascinating look at the future of drug discovery. And of course, you know, as almost every conversation does these days, it includes speak about AI and how it's transforming whatever it is, in this case, chemistry at its core. But for those of us outside chemistry, what is the problem you were trying to solve and why does it matter?
Yes. So I think I'll go to the start. So experimental science like chemistry and physics and biology, those experiments are incredibly difficult. They're expensive. The results can be sometimes misleading and ultimately ways to take the experimental data you have access to and use that in some sort of machine learning process to accelerate discovery or development is an area that my group has now been working in for almost 15 years. And the general idea here is we're never going to be able to build data sets that are really large, like you see in other parts of society. And that's really, again, an experimental limitation where hundreds are possible, thousands are sometimes possible, hundreds of thousands are really, really difficult. And so most machine learning or AI algorithms are really data hungry. And so we have to find ways to take the bits of data we can get and turn it into some sort of prediction. And so that's the basis of it. You know, the drug discovery part of it really just had to do with the application we chose, but this could be applicable in material science and other aspects of chemistry and society.
Yeah, that's great. And that's one of the wonderful things about developing these kinds of models is that once you develop it in one area, like you say, it can be applied to many others. But when we talk about, for example, developing new drugs, can you talk about, you know, the trial and error, the experiments that are needed to conduct or to get to what you're trying to solve? Yeah,
right.
How much time and money does that take?
I mean, yeah, I'm certainly not expert in the time and money part because it definitely depends on the drug itself. But usually drug discovery campaigns and process development campaigns, which is when you find one or two of these guys that you want to scale to deliver to phase trials, this takes a decade usually on the order and often around $1 billion. That number can be quite different depending on the development campaign, but ultimately these are really expensive processes and lots of time. So what you would love to be able to do is take the information that you already have and you know what seed a next drug or in our case a new reaction or whatever that may be to accelerate key steps in that process. There's a couple key kind of problems you have in drug discovery. One is first, you know, finding the molecule class that is the most apt to get the response you want. And then it's fine tuning of that molecule, which is what my group more works on, fine tuning that molecule for its specific function. And then finally, you have to make it really efficiently and on relatively large scale. And that requires also fine-tuning the reactions by which you make the molecule. So there's lots of steps. And I'm not even talking about the biology really here. I'm just talking about the chemistry. So I think the listeners an idea of it's really challenging. It's a needle in a haystack is what it is.
Wow. And a needle in a haystack, if you're doing it sort of in an analog way, as we know, I mean, that's right. a Kind of a good metaphor for it, a needle in a haystack. We know trying to find it, just picking hand, each person one by one is going to take forever. And so this
It
new,
does.
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, they have ways to screen more molecules in modern times. It's called high throughput experimentation. But even those are pretty limited. Like I said, the data set sizes are still going to be modest. But historically, people would do these types of evaluations, and that data wouldn't be used prospectively so much. It would be used retrospectively. And so I think that's what's changing these days.
I see. Okay, so talking about manipulating a single molecule into something that works for, to solve your problem or to figure out what you're looking for, there's something called a mirror image, and it's talking about how you kind of manipulate the molecule. Could you explain that?
Yeah, it's a term called chirality, and we all know it pretty well because our hands are mirror images of each other, right? And the way you want to think about it is one hand can fit into the appropriate binding pockets of a protein, that's the target perhaps, and the other one, because it's a very different shape, will not. So these are called enantiomers, and there's much history in this space about one being quite effective and one being poorly effective, if not dangerous. And this is an area of it's an area of synthetic chemistry that my group has worked in many years, but it goes back to the 1960s and 70s. A few Nobel Prizes have been awarded in this basic area, and it's to how you make molecules effectively in a single enantiomer, at least close to that, in a reaction. And that's all integrated into the drug discovery process because you need to be able to access these enantiomers very effectively. And that's the connection that this paper at least had to drug discovery. We don't do drug discovery in this study. It's more about how you make these chiral molecules effectively and using sparse data or small amounts of data to build machine learning models.
So the chiral molecule, so one version of a molecule might help you, but the other-handed or
Yeah.
new word for me, chirality, the mirror version might do nothing, or it might even harm you.
That's right. That's right. There, like I said, you could talk. There's many, many stories about both. But m the FDA allows you only to deliver a single enantiomer of a drug. So, and that's even if it's not harmful, they just want that as a means to make sure everything is safe. And so, that's the idea of why the synthesis of these molecules can be extremely difficult sometimes.
If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with Distinguished Professor of Chemistry at the University of Utah, Dr. Matthew Sigmund. We're talking about new research that the University of Utah is collaborating on with other organizations, accelerating drug discovery through machine learning and AI. It's dramatically cutting the time, cost, and trial and error required to develop these life-saving medicines and many other discoveries. It's a brave new world. Dr. Sigmund, sometimes it seems to me like a Saturday Night Live skit of some sort when I see a new drug, come on an advertisement on
Oh.
the TV for a new drug. And then almost in like hyperspeed, they say, side effects could include, and all these
Yep.
like awful, awful things. And you say,
Right.
well, certainly the initial illness would be much better than experiencing all these awful side effects. But is the kind of work you do in manipulating, all of this chemistry, I mean, is there more hope in these new advancements and this new research in kind
Yeah,
of,
I'm not a medicinal chemist, so answering
right?
that question is a little tricky. My take on it is the modalities, which is the kind of different molecule types that we have in our current pharmaceutical industry. You've heard of biologics, that's these antibody-derived compounds often, and they're small molecules, which are the ones that you're most familiar with, like the aspirins, Tylenols, things like that, and the other common ones that we see. These are all been moving towards much more precision, and and therefore their complexity as a function of the precision goes up. And that's what we're seeing in modern medicine. So I think the hope is that we will have compounds or sets of compounds that do what we want to do without side effects. Now, what timetable that is, I have no idea. Probably not my lifetime, but I'm just, I'm saying that because, someone who works closely with pharma sometimes on some projects, these molecules they're making these days look much more complicated, even to a chemist's eye, than they did 10 years ago. And so, and therefore the synthetic work to make them is more elaborate. And so therefore you also want to have tools available to accelerate any part of the process, to be quite honest. And so that's, again, that's where my group has worked for the last number of years.
So most, if we're talking about this model, most AI systems need these huge, massive data sets, right?
Yes.
But this one apparently is just you learning from a very few studies and, makes really accurate predictions, even for some new unseen reactions.
That's right. Yeah. And so, I'll preface this with it's not a panacea. It's as most of these studies go, it's certainly very focused on a couple of goals at this stage. But the idea is, and I'll go back in history. So machine learning, for the general audience, I'm sure folks have heard the term a lot. Some know it, some don't. It's pretty straightforward in concept, and that is you take some sort of response. So let's say it's yield of a reaction, how much material you get at the end. You then have to describe how those molecules look in a computer way, which is numerically. So you have to describe the molecule some way with numbers. You take those two inputs and you run some algorithm, and that algorithm gives you some sort of predicted versus measured fit. That is the basis of machine learning. And so the trick to this all, and it's been something, again, my team has been thinking about for many years, is what is the best way to describe the molecules themselves? So you could describe them really simply or much more sophisticatedly. And the more simple the way you describe the molecule, often what you need is more data to understand nuance. The more sophisticated ways, which are much, much more expensive, and that's the dirty secret of our study, is you have to describe the molecules like how they actually react. And practicing chemists have been thinking about this forever, and honestly, intuition is a driver in my field very intensely. That said, what we did in this study, the real kind of secret sauce, is that we were able to find a way to describe how the molecules react in a real-time way. It's expensive computationally, but we found a way to bypass some of the most expensive steps. And that allowed us to build these very relatively simple models that allowed us to do, predictions of unseen reactions. And that's the big deal. And we are certainly taking this workflow now out for a ride on many other studies currently.
Yeah, that's really exciting. So, we talked earlier about how this model could be applied, beyond just drug discovery, but can you give us an idea of where you see the most hope in the next, say, 5, 10 years?
Yeah, I mean it's a lot of reactions that we're working on in the group, and some of my collaborations. But right now we're working with a team on trying to understand how to make better versions of polystyrene. So material science basically, and we're working on new reaction types that haven't been done before, and trying to accelerate those discoveries with this workflow. All of these have applications either in basic science or applied science. And that's what's so fun about doing machine learning and chemistry for at least my team, is we work in really diverse areas, and it's a great training space for my students and postdocs who work on these projects. So I didn't answer very precisely, but it's a general tool, and we're pretty excited to see where the limitations are and also how broad can it be. And how much faster can we make it? I mean, that's the other part of it. It's you know, the thing about AI and ML is speed is essential. If you can run experiments faster than you can build your models, that's not going to be something people use.
Yeah. Wow, the nuance here is pretty incredible, but also if you start thinking about, I mean, okay, so you mentioned making these discoveries within polystyrene. Could you go into that? I mean, that's material science, but what would be an application there?
I mean, what's funny is I'm not an expert at all in this field, but the application is this tunable polymer properties, right? So, and there's obviously also the issue of how do you deconstruct some of these polymers, and so you can imagine these kind of tools helping you understand how you make a polymer property you want, but it's also deconstructible and not going to harm the environment. So that's the space I think a lot of us are aiming towards in the next decade in the area of polymer science. And again, the machine learning part of it is what my group does. We don't do the polymer science ourselves, but the machine learning part is what my group does. And so we, you know, if a collaborator often will come to us and ask us some sort of specific question, we then will figure out how we can apply these types of tools and algorithms to their goal. But often I think it fits this one idea, which is we want really tunable properties, predictably tunable properties, and also the predictability of what we can do to that polymer at the end of its life and not harm the environment. I think all of us like this idea. In practice, it's still pretty far out, but I think it's not as far out as it was even 5 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, when you said polystyrene, it made me think of all of the compostable types of materials that there are out there right now. And I pick up one of these, I put my food waste into a compostable bag, and
Right.
we've talked forever about how plastic never goes away. Now we've got compostable plastic, as
Materials.
quote unquote material, and that kind of thing. Yeah, it's so exciting, and to think about all of that, the applications and implications, really. So you mentioned, so you are a researcher and also a professor at the
That's
University
right.
of Utah. Okay.
Yeah,
And
I teach. I was chair. But I run a very large research team. I have 25 people in my research team, and then we collaborate with around 25 groups across the world and in industry. So the footprint is pretty crazy. Keeps me quite busy. But yeah, that's I'm a. I mean, my role is professor.
right. Okay. Because yeah, you throughout the interview, you've mentioned your team. And I always love to brag on the University of Utah because I think it is an amazing institution, especially within the sciences, that may not get enough publicity for the work that you do there. And I'm constantly amazed. And so the 25 people that make up your team, they are graduate students, postdoc, how is it?
Yeah, the makeup is about 10 postdocs, 10 graduate students, and five kind of random people, either visitors or visiting professors or occasionally undergraduates. So that's the general makeup. It changes pretty rapidly. I have 10 people finishing this summer, so it's insane, but
Wow.
massive turnover. It
That's
happens.
losing a
Most
lot
of them
of.
are get most of them are getting jobs, which is extremely exciting. So. But yeah,
That's really
yeah, so.
exciting. And then you mentioned that you work with all of these other organizations throughout the country. Are they also universities, or what types of organizations, and how do you manage?
Yeah, so I have multiple collaborations with the pharma industry. Most of these are you would construe them as academic collaborations where we get a project together that is, you know, not part of their business plan, but basically learning how to use the tools that we have developed. And so it's very interactive. So we do some chemistry with them, we do some machine learning. So like last year with AbbVie, Genentech, Merck, Pfizer,
Okay.
Folks like that. It's a lot of fun. It's great for my students who are getting trained because they have live interactions with people who are already in jobs that they may want.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. It's a great pipeline. Well, Dr. Matthew Sigmund, distinguished professor of chemistry at the University of Utah, so appreciative of your time today. It's a really interesting field, and
Yes, thank you.
yeah, best of luck as you continue on. We'll be watching what you do.
Yeah, thanks so much.